Dear friends, the English language, many claim it to be the richest tongue in the world. It is the environment in which our thoughts and our speech daily swim. So we'd better get it right. So here we are with a new book devoted to getting it right. A lot of the confusion over this book, I think, was the fact that it was originally published anonymously and it had a preface by the aforesaid Shelley. And so people concluded, quite wrongly, as Dr. Robinson has proved, that it was not by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Fantasy, the fantastical, was used by Shakespeare. Oh, brave new world that hath such fancies in it. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin has added greatly to our shore of the fantastical. She was in bed and should have been asleep. Incidentally, I think she was in bed alone. There was some discussion of that previously. But I think she was certainly undisturbed because, in her own words, she should have been asleep when she saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. Typically, the idea hatched itself from that productive hypnoid state between sleeping and waking. Of course, in those days, the term hypnoid had not been invented, but it's certainly a very curious state of mind when the old original grey matter of the brain attempts, without language but with pictures, to communicate with the newer white matter in the front of the brain. That's what I think a hypnoid state is, and Mary Shelley is not the only one who enjoyed that particular inspiration. So, a Frankenstein day, a new volume published. That's amazing. A torrent of learning. I've made some notes here, which I can't read, of course. I just wanted to have the absolute temerity to quibble on one point of our learned friend's remarks. I don't think that the book is a warning against science. I think rather it's a gentle chiding of people who don't look after their children. And among those people, of course, is Percy Bysshe Shelley himself, who deserted his wife and his two children. She eventually drowned herself. I don't know whether that might be the case, but certainly it's something that does occur to one, and that Mary Shelley was well aware of how important bringing up children were. So how is it that this story remains topical, dealing as it does with questions of identity and foreignness, and in particular with being, you know, being with a capital B, about our consciousness that there are parts of our cranial structure to which we scarcely have access. That, of course, is when you get this hypnoid state. It's one sort of the brain communicating with another. And that, I think, is where much of the interest of Frankenstein resides, quite apart from the Boris Karloff aspect. Mary Shelley has bequeathed us not only a perennial example of the fantastical, but a trail of confused additions and prefaces and interpolations. Variations in early editions have proved a bibliographical puzzle in their own right. And Dr. Robinson has now cleared away those entanglements in this bold new Bodleian Library publication. Some of us recall that Dr. Robinson, he's been very modest about this, but he lent his talents to a phenomenon which is almost as extraordinary as Frankenstein itself. That is to say, the Pickering and Chatto complete works of Mary Shelley, published in the 1990s. Unusual, did I say? Can you think of any other novelist whose complete works, and in such an elegant edition, have first been published 150 years after her death? It's a phenomenon in itself. The old anti-feminist rumour that Percy Bysshe wrote the novel is scotched forever. Yes, I did call him a creep. A lot of his poetry is wonderful, but that doesn't stop him being a creep. There's an argument on at the moment about how the most ghastly people write the most beautiful poems. Somehow one thinks of Wordsworth. Anyhow, this idea that Percy Bysshe wrote the novel has now been scotched forever. Anyone who's had the rotten luck to read Shelley's Gothic novel, Jastrozzi, will long know the idea to be preposterous. A teenager. She was a teenager, you know? Not the sort of female teenager today's newspapers would have us believe. Mary came from a civilized and, well, crowded, but a civilized home. Literature, science, and politics were regularly discussed there. Coleridge read his poetry there. To see and to hear Samuel Taylor belting out the Ancient Mariner, it might not have been to everyone's taste, or a bit like early Doctor Who. But it is actually something to have a living poet rampant in the parlour. Even if aided and abetted, I might say, by a substance. Well, Mary was aware that new things had developed and that the world was opening up. In the same way that we're aware now, they're closing down the shop, victims of our own cult of greed. However, let's get on to something much more cheerful. My own book, My History of Science Fiction. It was called Billionaire Spree. And when I was attempting to write it, I knew I had to begin at the beginning, as one does. And at the same time, there were a lot of people who were very eager to find who was the father of science fiction. And I was very happy to proclaim that Mary Shelley was the mother of science fiction. It caused a lot of bad blood at the time. Happily, it was spilt and has been mopped up now. As if to prove this unsuspected truth, Mary later wrote another futurist novel, The Last Man. As in the way that a scientist doesn't announce his discovery until he can repeat it. To make this claim, which I took here to buttress with examples, was not only to retrieve the book to current attention in a way that my readers might at first resent, but would ultimately profit from. I wanted also to retrieve it, of course, from the hands of Universal Studios' horrific Boris Karloff, because I saw it as so much more than a horror tale. And it had mythic quality. Dr. Robinson says, "Myth is no more or less than a symbolic language designed to express an essential truth." And I think that's absolutely the case. His new invaluable book, which, if you haven't already bought, you're about to do, is designed to disentangle the complexity of building this myth. Much had to be built, much had to be rebuilt, and some discarded. Not only Shakespeare, long before Shakespeare, the fantastical had been in vogue. It was eternally in vogue. Aristophanes' The Birds creates a crowd cuckoo land between earth and heaven. Someone wrote the music to it, I forget who. Then there's Lucian of Samosata in the first century of our epoch, who describes how the king of the sun and the king of the moon go to war over the colonization of, can you guess? The colonization of Jupiter. Well, well, I know it because I looked it up in the Wikipedia. Christendom was full of angels and lots of fibs about all the planets being inhabited. One's knee-deep in these old discarded fantasies, but it was Mary Shelley, poised between the Enlightenment and Romanticism, who first wrote of life, that vital spark being created, not by divine intervention as hitherto, but by scientific means, by hard work and by research. That's new. That was new, and in a sense it remains new. The difference is impressive, persuasive, permanent. You'll recall that in Ingolstadt, Professor Krempe, it sounds like a German food stuff, doesn't it? Professor Krempe mocks the old and learned names, Paracelsus et al. Well, antiquity is no longer the court to which we must appeal. The crucibles are hotting up. Of course, nothing was understood of asepsis at this period. The growth of microorganisms in the body had yet to be studied. Such was probably the cause of Mary Wollstonecraft's death. That's Mary Godwin's mother, when her daughter was born. Thus, the jumbled components of the creature all fit together without harm. For a perspective on Frankenstein, we could do worse than read his later novel. I just want to have a word about The Last Man. It was published in three volumes early in 1826. Mary no longer a teenager, of course. Various personae in that book take on the mantles of Percy Shelley and Gordon Byron. But they're both dead and gone. Mary writes for a living, well-travelled route to penury. She has resort to padding. That's the way you sometimes have to make your living if you're a writer. I'm not speaking personally, of course. Being only a reader and not a scholar, I'm at liberty to say that I find the first volume of The Last Man confused and deadly dull. Matters improve once the plague gets going, and then dire events and forebodings interpenetrate the text. We are asked, for instance, what are we, the inhabitants of this globe, least among the many people that inhabit infinite space? Our minds embrace infinity. The visible mechanism of our being is subject to merest accident. Well, Frankenstein ends in gloom. You remember perhaps the last sentence, or perhaps at some future date you will remember the last sentence. He was soon borne away by the waves and lost in darkness and distance. The conclusion of the last man is relatively cheerful. The last man sails on down the Mediterranean under, and I quote, the ever-open eye of the Supreme. Mary had to earn her living, and so she had to soften her approach to the Supreme to sustain an audience, I believe. Whereas Frankenstein stands alone, or is prompted only by that little clique on the shores of Lake Geneva in an inclement summer, the last man has company. A sense that the end was nigh. Thomas Campbell wrote a poem of the same name, and John Martin, that strange painter, paints the scene together with a similar and quite as uncomfortable theme of solitude. These misgivings were prompted by news of a plague emanating from Calcutta, really the capital of all diseases, I'd say. So anyhow, this plague advanced eastwards towards Tehran and Basra, where the bodies of the dead were too numerous to bury. It also spread eastwards to the vast hunting grounds of China. Its name was cholera. A second pandemic followed. From Moscow, it spread along the Danube. It infected 1 million people in Hungary. Krakow fell. Warsaw, Riga. In 1831, the plague crossed the sea to Sunderland, and from then on to Scotland and London. So that this novel of Mary Shelley's is prodromic, possibly the first coinage of what became a favourite science fiction currency, the prodroma, the by speaking out a defence against the evil that might come. They were so young in those dear Darty days. Percy was born in 1792, and Mary 5 years later. Today's new Bodleian book, I must give it another plug, I can't resist it. Today's new Bodleian book reveals rather charmingly how they worked together on the body of Frankenstein. I think Percy's a bit of a creep, but I must say his additions are frequently helpful, although at one point he rants unnecessarily about class distinction in England. It had no effect. But here we can also read Mary's original text, written when she was still a teenager and without any other finger in her writerly pie. Another aspect remains ever, ever vivid, pervading all editions. The creature has a negligent father and no mother. Mary had a negligent father and no mother. Hence the creature's cry, reversing Christian doctrine, I am malicious because I am miserable. It is that pervasive and melancholy sense of loss which gives the creature its puissance and provides the force that propels this beautiful, notorious story along. Brilliant, sad Mary Shelley. She did indeed speak, as she says, to the mysterious fears of our nature. She died, as did J.M.W. Turner, in 1851, the year of the Great Exhibition. If only she could have seen this new resurrection. Thank you.